Why don't you start by describing what your gig at Microsoft is now and what your career path has been there?
I'm a principal dev lead for Live Search, used to be MSN Search, and I started at Microsoft back in the late 90s working in Microsoft's press organization, where we actually were developing training software for that would emulate new Microsoft products, so but didn't require those products to be on a user's machine. So for example, if you had an organization that was running Windows 95, we would have a training system for Windows 98 that would emulate a bunch of the functionality of Windows 98 so that you could deploy it out to your people. They could train their people on how to use Windows 98 before they actually deployed it. I then moved on to the Microsoft Press website where I became the dev lead for it, moved from there, made a few other moves, ended up going to Microsoft.com where I ran the download center, the Microsoft.com homepage, the product catalog, and a bunch of other places from a dev perspective. I then moved to what was then MSN Search back in about 2005. And started was there through the MSN to Live transition. And at the time, I wasn't working on performance. I was just working on the Live Search application. And it became very obvious that we had some major performance problems. And performance has always been one of my really strong interests. And so I took on addressing a lot of those. And it be when we addressed a lot of them, we had very significant improvements in our business metrics. And that really surfaced how important performance was to the organization. And I moved into a role where I was really focusing just on performance. And I've been in that role now for about 2 years.
You've worked on at least three very different parts of the Microsoft website. The homepage is lots of hits, fairly static. The download page is a lot of data for long periods of time. Live search is high volume, but there's also a lot of backend on that. In what ways do you need to architect them differently, and where can you reuse the same lessons?
Wow, so that's a great question. On the web, you've got different concerns of what you have for client apps. The main things that tend to impact end user perceived performance on the web are often things about how you've designed your application from a network perspective. So how many different HTTP GET requests are you making? How are those GET requests structured? So for example, are they serialized? Do you have a JavaScript file that then gets returned to the browser that requests another JavaScript file and another JavaScript file and then some content and then it finally gets rendered? The number of assets that you request, that's going to be something that's important no matter what product you're doing. There's other things like how much script you have on the page, how much CSS you have on the page, how much actual simply content are you rendering to the page, etc. There are tricks that you can use, like combining many different graphics into a single tiled image and sending that down to the browser. It's much faster to send one image to the browser than, say, 20 images, even if you end up sending the same overall graphics, they've just combined into one, it's still much faster to send it as one request. They were different in very substantial ways. It had totally different backend concerns, like you brought up. There are also different data volume concerns. They're also different from a business perspective. A lot of what we were sending out from the download center was extremely time critical. We would have a update go out, and we needed to make sure that this update was going to be available anywhere in the world within a very certain time frame, which required us to handle very high bandwidth, very high volume of requests coming into the site that were transferring lots of bits. So that required something totally different than something like the Microsoft.com homepage. It's also interesting looking at the volume of traffic and how that traffic reflects real users. So for example, one of the problems that you end up with on both the MS on the Microsoft homepage and the and live search is that we have a huge number of bots that are trying to hit the system. Lots of people trying to do SEO work are trying to hit search engines to gather information about their site, about competitor sites, about all sorts of things. On the Microsoft.com homepage, it's always under distributed denial of service attack. It's not a question of how frequently does it happen. It's just what is the rate right now. There's also on the Microsoft.com homepage, it historically has had such a high uptime rate that it's actually hit by a lot of hardware devices simply to check for connectivity to the internet. And so you'd want to treat a request from that kind of user, in quotes, very differently from a request that's coming from a real end user. You could prioritize it differently, et cetera. So that's kind of a long rambling answer to your question there. Do you have any areas you'd want me to drill in or maybe talk about something else?
Well, it actually does lead right into the next question on my list. You mentioned denial of service, and certainly Microsoft is a high-profile target. How much of the effort involved in running the sites is directed at thwarting that type of thing?
I wouldn't estimate it at a percentage of of effort, but it's definitely an investment that we make in our infrastructure. So there's lots of different ways that you can prevent that, ranging from preventing the requests from getting to your data center at all, preventing it at the load balancer level, preventing it at your application level, et cetera. And we make efforts at all of those different levels. It becomes just part of the general sort of cost of doing business. We also do make some, we have developed some independent systems that run in addition to sort of the cost of developing any feature. We have systems that just help take that load before it would ever hit the application. So, it's definitely something that we work on regularly, but it's not a massive amount of our investment because we've paid a lot of that cost years ago.
I have to ask, given that just by the nature of the market share, a lot of the botnets are obviously Windows boxes. Do you ever feel a little bit like you're being shot with your own gun?
Well, you know, we deal with the world the way it is. So a lot of the boxes out in the world are Windows boxes. So, they're definitely going to be the ones running a lot of the botnets. A lot of the attacks that we get aren't necessarily coming from botnets. A lot of them can even be, you can generate a lot of load simply from a very small number of machines. It's also not necessarily about creating a lot of load. Oftentimes it can be just generating the right load. And so people are trying to attack us with maybe only a few clients that are just trying to hit us, trying to search for some sort of vulnerability,
right? Or trying to use vulnerabilities in the protocols themselves.
Exactly.
How heavily does Microsoft eat their own latest and greatest dog food? Is everything C sharp now, or is there some ancient code lurking around in places?
There's always ancient code in any large organization, but it depends on what group you're in. And it depends on sort of the mission of that group. So when I was at Microsoft.com, which I can talk about more publicly than what goes on in search, part of the core mission of Microsoft.com was to eat the dog food of the core platform teams. So for example, we had live site. Our major properties were running on the very first betas of ASP.NET more than a year before it was actually publicly released. So we were out there running all of our core sites on this code well before it was released. And it was really a great experience because that may sound crazy, but it was so much better than what else was available at the time. And it was, it gave us the opportunity to give really great feedback to the team early on because it is a very large scale site. And so it gives them a really good test bed and real customer And it was good for us because we get to give feedback into the team and what's really important to us as a big customer.
Microsoft has done a lot of work providing dynamic language support through projects like Iron Ruby and Iron Python. Do those technologies find any traction internally?
Oh, yeah, actually. They don't. I think it depends a lot on what group you're in. Like in the research teams, they tend to be used more than the product teams that I've been on. But there's definitely all of the, we're all geeks. You know, you get geeks and you get neat technologies and the geeks will try and use them. And so I know that Iron Python, I've known quite a few people who have experimented with it for everything from build tools to little data analysis tools, et cetera. And so, yeah, they definitely get used. Most of the time, people are gravitating towards C Sharp for almost everything. But a lot of these tools do get used, absolutely.
At Velocity, you're going to be talking about deliberately degrading user experience to gather data. That seems to go against the basic DNA of every site administrator, even if it's just for a small group. First of all, how do you go about pessimizing user experience, and what kind of data does it allow you to gather?
Like any of the big sites, Google, Yahoo, Amazon, we have a experimentation platform. And what this lets us do is take some fraction of our audience, some bucket of our audience, and give them a different experience than other buckets of our audience. And so what we tend to do is have users in an experiment and users in a control. And we can give the experimental group pretty much any kind of different experience that we want. And then we have a analysis system that runs after the fact and compares end user metrics for those two groups. And so we can track everything from, you know, how much money did we make from each organization, from each of the groups, to what was the click-through rate, to what was the perceived relevance. You know, there's all sorts of different things that we can track. We make different business decisions based off of this data. And so one of the things that we've always wondered is how much of an impact does performance make on our key business metrics? And what we've tried to do is come up with many different ways of measuring a performance impact. So in some cases, we've been able to take some upcoming improvement that we plan on releasing, and before we release it to everybody, we'll release it to a small number of people first and see what kind of see what the metrics show. But most of the time, when we have something that we know is going to improve the experience for the users, we just want to get it out there to everybody as quickly as we can. In these cases, we ran several different classes of experiments. In some cases, we tried adding more content to the page just in the form of essentially HTML comments. So we made the page fatter. We made the page fatter in a bunch of different locations. We also tried adding different kinds of actual latencies to the page where we're actually putting a pause on the server for a certain period of time, etc. We were never routing more than a very tiny fraction of our users to this experience. And what we generally found was depending on how much of a latency we were adding or how much page weight we were adding, well, as you would expect, it impacted users different amounts depending on how much we did. In cases where we were giving what was a significantly degraded experience, the data moved to significance extremely quickly. And so we were able to tell when we delayed people's pages by more than half a second. It was very obvious that this had a significant impact on users very quickly, and so we were able to turn off that experiment. So the reasoning that we did it was it helps us make a strong argument for how we can prioritize work on performance against work on other aspects of the site. And I mean, I'm the performance guy. I don't like hurting end users in terms of performance, but if it helps me make a good, strong business argument, that to make other changes that will improve the experience for all of my users for all time to come. And it means that a small segment of users for a small period of time will experience what we think will likely be a negative thing, then, but we're not sure. It was a test worth running.
So it's the greatest good for the greatest number paradigm.
Essentially. And there's all kinds of things where as soon as you start using a testing system, you're going to end up with multiple experiences. And that's the whole point, is you're testing experiences against each other. You're going to have theories to begin with as to which one is a better experience. Yet you're still going to be subjecting a bunch of your users to the other experience. This was kind of the same thing. Like, if we had honestly found that increasing the size of the page by 4x didn't make a difference to users, we would have considered doing it because, you know, that's good data. That's not what we found. You know, hey, it does get worse. But we were able to identify also, if we put data on the page in one location, it seems to have less of an impact on the end user than if we put it in other locations. That's really good data for us to know. And we found that, hey, if we put it in other locations, it doesn't seem to have much of an impact on the user at all. And so that's really helpful for us because it helps us know where is it okay to make the page larger, where is it okay to put delays, because we can use that opportunity to give the user more things. Oh, I was just going to say, one of my favorite sort of quotes about performance is that the fastest page is an empty page, but it doesn't solve any end user needs. And it's all about what kind of costs are you willing to pay for what kinds of features. And this is to try and help us determine what is the base cost of making performance changes, and then we can use that when we're trying to evaluate what kind of features we want to ship in the future.
Some of that intuitively makes sense in the terms of, for example, you would think that content that's, as it were, below the fold on the page, that being delayed in loading won't be as obnoxious to a user as if the upper right or upper left-hand content is. Is that the kind of stuff
Exactly.
you were seeing?
We looked at that and we did find exactly that. Although it did depend on what sort of content you were delaying below the page and how the design of your page, how you had designed your page. So, for example, if you have things that you're waiting to do until onload occurs, then even if you are doing a lot of stuff that's below the fold, if it's delaying onload, then it's delaying some other functionality that might be important to the user. And so the overall architecture of the page may or may not be impacted by things that you're doing below the fold. It kind of depends on what your features are. And so what we've done is measured in a bunch of our user scenarios what kinds of things tend to impact the end user.
I wanted to turn for a second to the work you had done on the download site and how download sites seem to be evolving in general. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you went to a download site. It was an HTTP or maybe an FTP link to the raw file. You got it and you had it or you didn't. It seems like most of the major sites now have now gone to dedicated downloaders. Is that kind of an acknowledgement that HTTP just isn't up to a 3.5 gig file?
There's a lot of reality in that. Just if you lose a packet along the way, most of the browsers don't really support that well. There's also the fact that a download application can end up opening a lot more connections to your server and can be intelligent about that. You also have things like BitTorrent that let you pull pieces of it from many different locations. I was going around to some sites, downloaded some things last night, and you know, some of them use dedicated downloaders, some of them didn't. I would say it really kind of depends on what you're trying to download, but anytime that you get over a certain size file, it's very hard, especially in a worldwide environment, you will likely not have, there's a strong chance of not having a successful download experience once that file gets over a certain size. And in those cases, if you're just using a browser, and in those cases, you don't really have an alternative other than using some sort of tool that's going to gracefully recover or it be able to stitch pieces of many downloads together, et cetera.
We'll be talking to Eric Sherman, who's in charge of site performance for Microsoft Live Search. He'll be speaking at Velocity on measured impacts of page slowdowns on real users. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Sure. Thanks for calling me.